Mr. Hogan, thank you so much for coming in. The reason we're chatting today is November 17th. On that day in 1969, CKRW was launched, celebrating 50 years this year. So if you can, take us back 50 years and maybe a little bit about what it took to get this station that everybody knows and loves today on the air.
Well, it started out, I could go back further and just say I had the cable company and I'd spent a lot of time organizing that and launching that and running that. So I was familiar with the communications in general. And I thought it's time Whitehorse had a privately owned radio station. So that summer in 68, I was driving down to Vancouver on the highway, and I stopped at Fort St. John, stopped in Prince George. I visited radio stations in Vancouver, all to get a feel of how they were running their radio stations and so on. So I did a lot of research in advance, and then I hired from Vancouver a consultant who was an experienced communications consultant. And I hired him to do some preliminary work. And we had chosen a place for the radio station prior to that, and that's where the commissioner's office is today. I was going to buy that building, but my consultant came up and he walked around. He said, every floor squeaks, and that's not any good for a radio station. So I abandoned that idea. But at any rate, I applied to the CRTC, but by then others had known, and an individual in Fort St. John teamed up with an individual here in Whitehorse, and they too applied to the CRTC for a radio license. And so in 69, not sure of the date, I believe Buzz Hudson went down to Ottawa for the hearing, and the other group were also there, and they had with them an individual, Vic Wiley, who was a local lawyer, and he was acting for them for their application. I appeared before the CRTC first, and then the alternate organization, then they applied. And during the questioning by the CRTC, Vic Wiley said, I don't think Rolf Hogan should be licensed for the radio station. He owns the cable company, and he owns the Whitehorse newspaper, and I think that would be a concentration of the communications too much. Well, then I was on the stand next, and of course I told the CRTC I had nothing to do with the Whitehorse Star. And later, after the hearings were over, and Vic Wiley was a good friend of mine as well, but he was a lawyer for the other side, I said, Vic, how on earth did you tell them that I own the radio station? He said, well, I always thought you did. Or the fighter star. I always thought you did. So he didn't do his homework very well. Anyway, it wasn't long before I felt very confident we would get the license, because I already had a good relationship with the CRTC, knew most of the commissioners personally, because I'd spent a lot of time working with them on the cable company.
So if you can take us back to that day of November 17th, 1969, and the launch. I know we heard from Ron McFadgen, the first voice of CKRW. Take it back to that day, and maybe the excitement that was in the building at the time.
Well, of course, I was here, and several of my family members were here when we went on air. But I didn't go on air. I think I was interviewed that morning. I don't recall. Our manager then, who wasn't with us very long, but he had a good, solid background in radio business and did a good job in organizing it and putting it on air. And, of course, we hired McFadden out of one of the prairie towns where he was working, and he had a reasonable amount of experience as well. So we started out on a very well-organized basis.
What kept you going for 50 years?
Well, the station, as you could realize, there was always some staff problems, new managers. We went through quite a number of managers over the years. We've had a long period now of stable management. But I didn't involve myself on a day-to-day basis by any means. We had a manager who looked after all the operations and consulted me when he felt he had to consult me. The whole period of time, we had issues that we had to deal with the CRTC at one time when we were doing talk back shows, and very controversial, and so we'd have to send them a recording of what was said, and we never got any negative CRTC feedback. They were quite satisfied that everything was done properly, but that would keep us busy. And, it's hard to remember all the details, but McFadden was a continuity for a long, long time. And then one of the stores on Main Street wanted to hire him to run their store, so he left us for a period. This was Murdoch's Gem Shop, but it didn't really work out. And he then joined, we didn't need him back at that point, we had all the positions filled. He joined CBC for a period of time and then rejoined us quite a long period in the latter part of his career.
Are you amazed? Because when CKRW opened in 1969, state-of-the-art equipment. And even as I'm using the equipment, it's still state of the art today. Are you amazed at the way radio equipment has evolved over the years compared to 50 years ago when you had big, bulky, reel-to-reel recorders?
Well, I was in touch with a firm in Washington State, and we ended up buying a system be almost the fill that whole wall, and it was so-called an automated system. However, it never really worked very well. We couldn't count on it all the time. You'd have little pins you'd put in holes all over to control what was going to go on. It was state-of-the-art at that time, but it wasn't too long. I've forgotten the period, but we wanted to let the station run on its own at nighttime after midnight, but we could never be sure that unit would carry on until the morning. We had a taxi company. We asked them to monitor the station. If there was any breakdown, they could give us a call. We didn't have any breakdown, but we did have the taxi company alerted if we should have a failure. That equipment, I still got pieces of it, but it was big, huge reel-to-reels. I should show you a picture of it because it was very large, looked very impressive, but questionable in its reliability.
I think there's a picture of it downstairs in the lobby. It could be mistaken on the stairs. Yeah. But that was a pretty menacing piece of equipment. That's good to hear. community connection, and the station, and everyone knows over the years what you know, being connected to the community is. This what you envisioned when you started 50 years ago?
Well, I think we followed a program that we already had mapped out before going on air, and it included a half hour religious programming early in the morning, and it also included what is still running, two programs. One is Trader Time, and the other is Birthday Greetings. The Birthday Greetings, then, we would phone in during the exact time. They would phone in live. Now they phone in, it's recorded and then played, which I guess is more reliable that way. But over a period of time, one of our features that got us a lot of listeners and got us into a lot of trouble from time to time was talkback. Because we had 5 days a week, we had guests, and some of these guests would be very controversial even before they got on air. And so there would be nasty phone calls on occasion. There would be explanations by them. And it was the talkback that caused us to get many requests from the CRTC, as they had received complaints, to send them copies of a certain day that people were complaining about. And as I said earlier, the CRTC never criticized us whatsoever the way we ran it. But that made it exciting. And I wouldn't mind if we went back to, and maybe not 5 days a week, but say Thursday, Friday every week from 11 to 12, we went back to a talkback show, because there's so many people now. You know, our population then went from 10, 15, 20,000 people. We're up to 30,000. There's so many people to be interviewed and have interesting careers or interesting stories to tell. So I'm going to discuss with the management of the station whether they think they could figure out a way to put talk back on at least 2 days a week.
And speaking about communities, that you considered UConn a community, and in recent years you've included Inuvik Northwest Territories. Why was that important to you to have Inuvik have a transmitter and broadcast CKRW?
Well, see, Inuvik is connected to the Whitehorse by road. They're not connected to Yellowknife or anywhere in the Northwest Territories. And I thought that for people who are traveling and driving up to Inuvik, they could listen to RW here, and they could listen to it out of CarMax, because we have repeaters in all these communities. They could listen to us out of Dawson City. And then when they got to Inuvik, they could still listen to us, and that's happening today.
Celebrations over the last few days, we had the business after hours at the McBride Museum. We also had a tribute in the Legislative Assembly. What do you make of all this, you know, in as part of the celebrations here of the golden anniversary?
Well, 50 years is a long time, I think, for a radio station in a smaller community to be owned for that entire period by one group. And I think the community appreciates the station a great deal, because, well, you as a newsman know this, but you cover the news very, very well, and people tune in for the news. They tune in for some of the other shows, and in between they get today's music, which doesn't necessarily please me, but it does please the age group that we're mainly focused on, you know, maybe 18 to 40 or something like that. And the music is always current. You can turn on RW here and turn on a station in Vancouver, and you'll hear the same music in both areas. So it's, I think the station's very much appreciated by listeners. And we have, as our statistics show from time to time, and we have surveys, and also from the standpoint of looking at advertisers tell us that our station works for them. I had a recent advice that someone weren't sure that the radio was working very well, and they had an event they wanted to feature, and they used RW, and they got a good following immediately of the public in their store. It does work, and that's why people stay with us year in, year out.
Finally, what stands out for you over the last 50 years? I know we've gone through a lot of stories here, and but what really stands out for you when you think back for 50 years?
Well, at one time in the 40s, Whitehorse had about 30,000, 35,000 people, and that's when the Alaska Highway was built, and practically every major American and one or two Canadian companies were had offices and facilities in Whitehorse for building the highway. After the tide turned in Europe, and particularly after the Japanese tide turned, there was no longer a need for any of the contractors to be here, and quite a number of the children of contractors, and we also had the oil refinery where the oil was piped from Norman Wells here, and the refinery was producing gas for airplanes for a very short time. Then it wasn't needed. So a lot of the kids that I became very good friends with in grade 10, 11, 12 in school, they all left because the refinery closed down and the contractors were leaving. And it was not in 1946, there was a major change when the Americans who were running the highway left, and there was a big ceremony up on top of Two Mile Hill saying goodbye to the Americans. They left in 46. So then our population, we went as low again in Whitehorse, around 5,000-6,000. And it's been climbing ever since. We've had, we were based on tourism and based on mining, and that was about it. And the mines, while they were operating, it kept the community viable and busy. But there were periods when the prices of ore would go down, and the market for some of the minerals we were producing went away, and we hardly had any mines in operation for periods. So our population, we thought it would shrink. It certainly leveled off, but it never really shrank, if any, just a little bit. So our growth right in this 50-year period has continued every year. Right now, if we look at last year and this year, I'm quite sure we'll see another 500 population growth in the Yukon or more. And it's been 500 for quite a number of years of growth. And I think that will continue because whereas traditionally we're known as a gold producer through the mines principally in Dawson City, placer mining, but no hard rock gold. Well, now the placer continues and is important to employment of quite a number of people in Dawson area. But the big producers now, one that up in Mayo is now producing gold, and there's another much bigger one, Gold Corp. It should be pouring gold within 1 to 2 years, and it's a big mine that will employ, I think, 600 people. And the one in Mayo, as far as I recall, is 300 to 400. And then there's a third one at various stages of development. So we've gone from a hard rock mine for lead and zinc and silver and so on. We're now going to put gold into the hard rock category, and that's going to give a great deal of stability to the Yukon and considerable growth as well.
Mr. Hogan, thank you so much for doing this on behalf of Yukoners and especially here our staff at CKRW. Just thank you so much for all you've done over the years for the territory. And I certainly appreciate you coming in and chatting today.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to convey my thoughts to the public generally. And I've done that today on the mining scene, at least, and on communications.